I mean, I think it all comes back to trying to minimize circadian disruption, right? Like we want to try to create as much circadian alignment as possible. So that's eating while the sun is up, biasing a bulk of our calories earlier in the day, you know, ending, you know, finishing our last calorie a couple hours to 3 hours before we intend to sleep, stabilizing when we go to bed and when we wake up, doing that as often as we can, getting a lot of water, you know, really trying to minimize alcohol intake, putting nourishing, nutrient-dense food in our body, really important, you know, meeting our sleep need. You know, these are just like kind of the basic stuff, you know, and I would say, you know, working out, getting exercise daily, movement, really, really important. Trying to, you know, pay attention to that sedentary behavior and not let that, you know, creep into the hours and hours over the course of the day. You know, so it's just like a lot of the typical things.
It isn't about being perfect. It's about being better. Hello, my name is Dr. Stephanie Stima, and I host expert discussions with thought leaders in all facets of health, including nutrition, fitness, hormones, stress management, performance, recovery, longevity, health span, and energy production. On this show, we discuss complex science, but then we also alchemize it into actionable everyday living. The ultimate goal with the show is to assist you in making informed decisions about your health and to catapult you into being the hero in your own life. Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima, and today we are talking all about how to maximize recovery. We're going to learn how to recover like a boss and how to optimize human performance and potential. And my guest today is Kristen Holmes. And man, this woman is a powerhouse. She is the VP of Performance Science at Whoop. And just to give you a little bit of background on her, she is a three-time All-American, two-time Big Ten Athlete of the Year at the University of Iowa, competing in both field hockey and basketball, 2021 University of Iowa Hall of Fame inductee, a seven-year member of the U.S. national field hockey team, and one of the most successful coaches in Ivy League history, having won 12 league titles in the 13 seasons that she was at national championship at Princeton University. Kristen has an MIT Slogan Artificial Intelligence Certificate, an MA in Psychology and Sports Performance, a BA in Political Science from the University of Iowa. She's a PhD candidate from the University of Queensland. And Kristen serves as a science advisor to Levels Health, to Arena Labs, to Evolve Leadership. She's an performance ambassador to Liminal Collective and sits on the Tactical Leadership Board of Sports Innovation Lab. Yeah, she's kind of a big deal. So we talk all about how we can recover like bosses. So we talk about HRV, heart rate variability, what it is, what affects it. We talk about light and light inputs. We talk about sleep and sleep recovery, sleep debt, sleep wake timing. What do you do when you have a really big event coming up? There's a big wedding or a big reunion or something. We talk about the menstrual implications on metabolism and recovery. We talk about insulin resistance. Gosh, there's something for everybody in this conversation. And if I'm being totally honest, we didn't even get to all of the topics that I wanted to get to with her, but just the 90 minutes flew by. She's game for a second interview. So we're going to do that. We're going to try and figure that out and coordinate another time together. But in the meantime, this is like the foundational basics of circadian rhythm training. And of course, we talk a lot about women and include women of all ages, perimenopause, in our fertile years, etc. I cannot wait for you to hear this conversation. So before we get there, I do want to make sure that I just shout out one of you, my community, my Betties, reading out a review that came in from Apple Podcasts from the US. This is Bel Campo. And Bel Campo says, I love you, Dr. Stephanie. This is my go-to podcast, my mood booster, my health insight, my helpful tips, my lifestyle inspiration, my gym listen, my road trip muse, my favorite walking podcast. I could go on and on, but I love all of it. And Dr. Stephanie has got such a good thing going with this podcast. I'm 24 and I love it. So it just goes to show that the preventative health measures and hormonal expertise is very applicable to women in their 20s and not just women in perimenopause and menopausal stages of life. Bel Campo, Thank you so much. And I love that you are 24 and listening to this show. Like, man, what a competitive advantage. And so if any of you are finding value in the show, I would also encourage you, it's a free way to support the work that we do, to leave a 5-star rating either on iTunes or Spotify, or if you want to leave a review on iTunes, I see them all, the good, bad, and the ugly. So please do so if you feel that this is bringing value to your life in some way. All right. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Kristen Holmes. One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Boncharge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest, where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Boncharge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers, and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure, and that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to boncharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart. Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. You can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there is a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's BETTER. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com. All right. Kristen Holmes, VP of Sports Performance and Recovery at Whoop. I am just thrilled to welcome you to the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you today. I've been following you for such a long time and just such a fan of your work. And appreciate everything that you do to educate us on all things kind of health and performance. So thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I wanted you on the show really because we're going to do a deep dive in recovery. And one of the things that I've observed in myself and also with a lot of the individuals that I've counseled and cared for over many years is that fatigue management, recovery management, let's say, maybe the single greatest indicator of whether we're not going to be successful in our progress in terms of whatever our fitness and exercise goals might be. And as we, at least for me, as we move into our 40s, which is where I am now, one of the things that I think about a lot is injury prevention. And this is why recovery becomes so important, because we want to be thinking about progress, but also we also don't want to be taken out by an injury, because an injury in your 40s or 50s, let's say, is markedly different than an injury, let's say, in your 20s or 30s. And even then, you know, the arbitrary timeline that you set for yourself where you're like, I'm going to be better by Saturday. Saturday comes and goes and you're like, what the hell? You
know? Not so much.
Not so much. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So my observation has been, and this has been my own experience as well, is that recovery is more psychologically difficult than sort of psyching yourself up for like a big workout. And so I thought we might start with what are, you know, maybe defining recovery, why that's so important for any exercise, or even if it's not an exercise goal, even if it's not a personal goal, but why this is relevant for personal and professional goals. And then maybe we can start to parse apart some of the individual components of recovery.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a beautiful place to start, you know, and I actually love starting with definitions because I think that gives us a framework for how to think about our behaviors. And I like to define recovery as our capacity to adapt in a functional way to external stress. And I think like when we really break down, okay, are we actually adapting in a functional way? We can then start to unpack, okay, well, what does functional actually mean to me? And that's where you can really decide, well, who do I want to be in the world? And actually asking some of these bigger questions, you know, if I want to be able to adapt to life stress in a functional way, what is that actually required of me in terms of just my daily behaviors and in terms of how I show up in the world? And so I kind of think about it as, all right, if functional adaptation is a goal, what do I need to have foundationally in order to enable that? So I think from my perspective, you know, so if I back up and think about, okay, you know, what are my values? Like I want to live my values with joy and energy. What are those that I care about? I want to be able to be as present and engaged with my children as I possibly can. I want to be patient and tolerant, and I want to be kind. I want to be able to, you know, share my skills or whatever my skills are. I want to be able to, you know, share those with the world. So how do I kind of back into that? And I think one of the components is be able to kind of functionally adapt to stress, you know, as often as possible. And what that really means is that I have to kind of manage my stress very proactively. So that is, there's a sleep component to that, that basically, enables me to adapt to stress in a functional way. There's also a training component to that. You know, am I training appropriately relative to my capacity, right? And how am I thinking about that? How am I monitoring that? So I think that, you know, recovery, it's more than just recovery. I think it's really figuring out, okay, who do I actually want to be in the world, and how do I back into that?
So really, it's a definition of core values, right? First, we want to understand what we stand for and what we don't. And then what are some of the pillars that sort of stack up? What are some of the bricks that I can lay that's going to allow me to be to fully express who I am in whatever capacity that might be?
Yeah, absolutely. And people have different goals and levels, you know, but I think to your earlier point, like if we're injured or sick, it's really hard to live our values. You know, it's really hard to kind of show up in the world in the way that we want to. So I think at a fundamental level, you know, I think we, you know, I think most folks are really interested in not getting sick and not getting injured, right? as a path to be able to, you know, live their values, you know, as intentionally as possible for as consistently as possible.
You mentioned managing stress, and I just wanted to double click on this a moment before we sort of get into some of the components of recovery management and fatigue management, because I think this is so important. One of the things that I find, I see this more often maybe discussed in the online space as if, you know, stress is often discussed like cortisol is the devil, stress is the devil. We want to avoid this at all costs. And certainly overdoing it, as we're going to be talking about, can certainly impact our recovery and our ability to perform the next time that we're doing, you know, whatever activity we've set out for ourselves. And I think, you know, two truths can be possible at the same time. Stress is actually very important for us to grow. I think that, you know, people use the word hormesis. We're starting to see that word used a little bit more. But I do want to reframe the different types of stressors, right? We have eustressors, we have distressors. And I thought maybe you could speak into that a little bit, seeing as though you are the VP of sports performance and sort of knowing a little bit about how stress can impact our ability to adapt. How can stress be a good thing?
Yeah, I completely agree that I think society has kind of put this weird spin on stress and made it just bad, you know, that we should be inoculating ourselves from stress. And I totally disagree with that. I think it's really about, like, the number one thing is I think framing stress. And I think how we frame it, if we are, and I'll use an example of like a stressor that could be good or bad, depending on how we frame it. To use cold, for example, cold immersion. If I'm going into a 40 degree cold tub, which for most humans is going to feel really uncomfortable, and their body's going to feel really unsafe in that temperature. But if I go into it saying, okay, this stressor is going to help me, I'm going to I'm going to release dopamine. It's going to help my immune system. So I basically frame that stressor as positive. That will end up being a hormetic stressor in that it doesn't kill me, but it's making me stronger. So assuming that you're staying within the parameters of safety and all of that, very important. You're not getting hyperthermia. Like this is about just like, you know, a couple minutes in this cold tub with the goal of promoting, you know, positive stress. Now, if I were to go into that same situation where I get pushed off a boat into 40 degree water and I'm trying to survive, that's going to be a bad stressor, right? I'm going to perceive that stress as negative. As a result, it's going to manifest negatively in my system and probably not be a positive response or adaptation. So our mindset going into the stress is really important. And I think you bring up such an important point that we need to start to think about stress in our life as an opportunity for growth. And I think it's important to note that I think folks have a different default kind of mindset around stress in general. And that would be something that's worth unpacking at a kind of individual level is like, all right, how positive and optimistic do I feel about the future, right? And you can kind of look at Carol Dweck's work on growth mindset, which is great. You know, there's people kind of either go left or right, but you want to try to go, you know, if growth oriented and thinking, you know, positively about the future is to the right, we want to try to get to that as much as possible. So, and that's something that you can kind of train. And Sean Aker's work is absolutely amazing. It would be worth linking. He was a Harvard professor and done a ton of work around happiness, but really gives a lot of really useful tips and tricks on how to kind of frame the world in a more positive light. And a lot of that is, you know, entry points are awe and gratitude, but kind of that is a pathway to kind of improve our perception of just the world around us and look at the world through a more, you know, positive lens. I think helps us kind of think about stress more as an opportunity for growth as opposed to something that is going to kill us. So that's, I guess, a quick framing of stress.
Wonderfully said. And I think, you know, a lot of us, you know, a lot of people listen to this podcast and others because they want to become stronger and more resilient in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think that there can be sort of this paradoxical, you know, I want to be stronger. I want to be fitter. I want to be more resilient, either mentally or physically, but avoid the conditions that actually create that strength, right? Like the cold therapy, yeah. Right? It's like the cold therapy, you know, it's uncomfortable every time I get into my bathtub with that ice that I've dragged in from the gas station. I'm like, this is going to suck. Every time. Totally. I'm like, do I really need to do it this time? I already did it last time. Yeah. You have that little, like all these little, you know, but I get in anyway. And afterwards I always feel amazing.
Yeah.
You know? But these are the conditions that actually create some of that grit, right? That cellular grit, whether it's mental grit, physical grit. So I think leaning into the conditions that actually forge strength, right? I think is very important. And some of those things are very stressful.
Yeah. Yeah. You can kind of think about it I always think about it like a bank account. You know, you're either making a deposit or you're making a withdrawal, and you've got, you know, your bank account is resilience. Like you want to make as many deposits as you can, you know, and it's these little behaviors that really add up over time, you know, that are going to either upgrade your resilience levels, you know, i.e. reduce your, you know, your propensity or chance for injury, or sickness, or not, you know, and nothing is black and white, but I think there are some things that are going to, you know, be a without a doubt a deposit and without a doubt a withdrawal. And I think the more, and this is the crux of your work and hopefully my work too, is trying to help people understand, okay, how do I actually apply my effort? If my goal is to reduce injury and reduce sickness and, you know, be as healthy as humanly possible and show up for life in a way that feels good to me, what are these deposits that I need to make every day?
Awesome. Well said. All right, let's dive into some of the components of recovery. I've heard you on your podcast, on the Whoop podcast. So shout out to the Whoop podcast. We'll make sure that that's in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
You talk about HRV, and this is something that I love that this is so mainstream now. When I was in clinical practice, I had an HRV machine, and this was part of my intake. It was sort of a, you know, now there's so many more advanced sort of technologies, but we would make the patient sit there for 5 minutes and like read sort of the inputs, the autonomic inputs and whatnot.
Yep.
But let's talk about what HRV is and why this is such a salient signal, let's say, for how somebody is managing their stress.
Yeah. So I think really what HRV is an amazing proxy for is to understand how you're adapting to stress. So we kind of, you asked me that definition of recovery. It's our, you know, how well are we adapting to external stress? And HRV is kind of a measure of how well you're adapting to external stress. So I think that's what makes it really powerful. It's just kind of a nice, you know, daily or weekly check-in on, okay, am I positively adapting or am I adapting functionally or am I not actually adapting functionally? And so HRV is an amazing proxy and just high level heart variability is a function of the heart that originates in the autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system, I think, is really important to understand because this is where, you know, you're it's the rest and digest is the parasympathetic and the sympathetic is the fight or flight side of the branch of the autonomic nervous system. And they're both kind of competing to send signals to your heart. When you are recovered and ready to go, managing energy effectively, your heart's probably going to be responsive to both inputs of the autonomic nervous system. This is going to allow you to respond and adapt your environment in a really functional way. When your heart rate variability is suppressed, that means your heart is going to be less responsive to these signals. As a result, you are going to adapt in a less functional way to your environment. So imagine those moments where, you know, let's just say, you know, you're underslept, you're maybe overfueled, you're underhydrated, you're probably going to have a really suppressed heart rate variability. As a result, that's probably going to manifest in your life in some sort of probably suboptimal way. That is, you might be less tolerant or, you know, less optimistic. Like you can't turn on that mindset that's going to allow you to kind of look at a situation as an opportunity. And as opposed, you know, as a result, you're kind of seeing it as, you know, it's kind of that glass, you know, is half full. Yeah. Instead of half empty. Yeah. You're glass half empty as opposed to glass half full. You kind of have that like default, like negative mindset. So, so I think, you know, heart rate variability is just this awesome shot or window into how our behaviors are either laddering up positively, and enabling that functional adaptation or not.
And when we talk about ranges, so I'm going to out myself here and say that I have a relatively low HRV. I can modify it. You mentioned a few things that really, like my hydration really does impact my HRV levels. If I've gone to, you know, my husband and I have started going to this sort of Scandinavian spa where you just sort of go into a barrel sauna and then you do cold plunge and you just keep, you know, you continue to alternate. And so a day of that, you know, 4 or 5 hours of that, the next couple of days, my HRV is very, very high, but typically my HRV is very low. So I have a couple of questions for you. Well, I'll say low relative to other people where we're all checking and comparing our HRVs to each other, which is the wrong thing to do for the record.
Right? So our general population averages. So, you know, generally speaking, so on the Whoop platform for men, so for 25-year-olds, the average HRV is 78. 35-year-olds, it's 60. 45-year-olds, it's 48. And 55-year-olds, it's 44. Just to give you a sense of just, so this
that's
is just
men, is that
population data.
Yeah.
So this is, I just gave you all female ranges.
Female ranges. Okay. So I've heard generally you should try to have an HRV that's about your age. But that sort of goes contrary to sort of what your, can you read those numbers for me just again?
I sure can. Yep. So for 25-year-olds, the average HRV for women is 78. For 35-year-old women, it's 60. For 45-year-olds, it's 48. And for 55-year-olds, it's 44.
All right. So your girl here is still coming in under the average. Yeah. But I know part of it, like part of it is just me being able to process, you know, residue, let's say stressful residue that still resides in my nervous system, which I'm actively,
without a doubt,
actively working on. But there are things that I've noticed that really do help it. So the hot and cold manipulation, how well I've slept, of course, that's a huge one. And then my hydration levels, I do also see big changes there. Do we think that HRV is sort of to some degree genetically determined? Like, are there some people that I'd like to maybe excuse myself for working on my stress here, but are there some people that are just going to have a low HRV no matter what, or I still have a lot of personal work to do? Is what are we thinking, Kristen?
So HRV is modifiable.
Yeah.
Now it is going to decrease with age. There's no question. I know. Sorry. I can't look at the book. But you have to understand that it is genetic, and women in general are going to have a slightly lower HRV than men. And that's more to do with heart size than anything. But there is a genetic component that gives you kind of your baseline entry point. But that said, like, just even what happened, you know, when you're in your mama's belly can impact your kind of baseline heart rate ability. Any early childhood trauma that you might have experienced is going to impact kind of your baseline HRV. I know some folks in my life who have been, you know, struggled with alcohol for, you know, decades, and then get sober, come onto the platform, and they have like an 8 HRV, you know, and they're in their 40s. So your prior behaviors are going to influence kind of you're starting, like when you first start measuring heart rate variability, it's a product of kind of everything that's led up to that moment is going to impact. And then really, I think the focus for folks is, you know, can I make just small improvements over time? You know, and I think back to that little bank account, you know, there's going to be behaviors like you mentioned, you know, Dr. Stephanie, like you mentioned the hot and the cold, and minding your hydration. And there's some other like really important ones that we can talk about too that are going to put, you know, deposits in the HRV bank account and aren't detracting. But it's like all these little behaviors kind of add up over time and are going to and should improve your ability to respond and adapt to external stress, which is going to be reflected in that HRV metric.
Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I'm just looking at these numbers again. I wrote them down when you told me the second time. So what we're seeing here at 25, it's 78, 35, it's 60, 45, it's 48, 55, it's 44. We're seeing this sort of stepwise decline in HRV, which signifies to me that there's less, you might tend to run a bit more sympathetic dominant. Would that be a fair categorization there?
That's exactly right. So yeah, and that's where, you know, in your opening kind of, you know, monologue, you're talking about just, you know, stress being good or bad, you know, and that's where, you know, if you are not breaking up these moments of stress throughout your day, you end up being, you know, sympathetically, you know, activated, like your sympathetic branch, your nervous system is chronically activated. That is when you will see deleterious effects on your heart rate variability. So you want to make sure that, again, stress isn't bad, but you want to give yourself appropriate levels of rest that are proportional to that stress as proactively as possible. So oftentimes people go through, you know, 6 weeks of just chronic activation and are like, okay, now I'm going to rest. I go on vacation and I get deathly ill, right? Like that's your body is coming down from that stress. And I think there's a term for this. You might know it's sickness. I see this in my surgeon and military population.
I got sick after every set of exams, my board exams, I was sick for weeks. Yeah.
Your body is just mobilizing all the resources to be able to kind of do this thing that you need to do, you know, and you're just driving, your heart rate is, you know, kind of chronically elevated and you kind of get through it and you're like, all right, I did it. And then finally, like you come down and like the dopamine and the adrenaline and the cortisol, the epinephrine, like everything just roll. And that's when your body is like, okay, we don't need to activate anymore. Now like let's deal with all of the like the fact that I haven't been taking care of myself for 6 weeks. Now let's try to like get ourselves back to homeostasis here. And that's where your body is basically shuts down, like forces you to shut down so it can kind of, you know, do all of the recovery and regeneration that needs to happen that you've neglected over the last 6 weeks.
Okay. So I also think that looking at these ages, we sort of see the stepwise decline. This is also why recovery actually becomes more and more important as we age for that fatigue and injury
proactive
management.
Recovery.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So let's dive into some of the parameters or some of the verticals maybe that can help to increase HRV. So we're increasing our balance, if you will, of parasympathetic and sympathetic function. We've sort of danced around a few of them, cold therapy, but I actually wanted to start with light because I know that this is a really big part of some of the research that you do, and I've heard you speak so eloquently on it. So how does light, let's say, affect our circadian rhythms? How does it affect our ability to recover? What does that look like?
Yeah, light is the most powerful input in that it really tells our system what it is that it needs to do at different time points during the day. And so basically, you know, we've got this natural light dark cycle, right? So during the day, it's, you know, light out, it's bright out. During the night, it's dark out. And our system, our cells, our tissues, the organs in our body are all basically kind of just imagine they're just feeding off of these cues that we give it. And light is that big one. So it's basically when we see light first thing in the morning, it wakes our system up. It's like, all right, time to go, cells, tissues, and organs. Like we're fired up. We're ready to go. We're ready to tackle the day. We release cortisol. Like there's all sorts of hormonal things happening. If we deprive ourselves of light in the morning, that is, we don't get light, our system doesn't know what to do. And thus begins this kind of, I think, syndrome called circadian misalignment. Now, of course, one day, not a big deal. But if we're chronically missing that bolus of morning light, we will become desynchronized. And your circadian rhythm might adapt, but it doesn't mean that you're performing optimally or that you've adapted in a functional or healthy way. You will adapt to a lower level of functioning. You will increase your risk of disease. You will increase your risk of injury. So that bolus of light in the morning is so important. And at the other end of the spectrum, once the sun goes down, we need to do our very best to restrict our light. We have not adapted to blue light after the sun goes down. And I think that we haven't evolved to adapt to blue light after the sun goes down. And I think that this, you know, modernity makes it so difficult, right? It sabotages us at every corner in terms of our health, right? And I think light is, and just having access to light 24/7 is one of the biggest problems facing human health. I think that we can experience, like that we're kind of as a society we're faced with. And you know, people are watching TV. They're you know, engaged on their smartphones and their iPads, and they just get this blue light. And as a result, you don't feel sleepy when you need to feel sleepy. You bypass that melatonin release, or you push past that melatonin release. And once you push past that melatonin release, now all of a sudden your body's like, oh no, I'm not safe anymore. And I need to mobilize resources because I need to fight and I need to flight. So as a result, like you end up, you know, basically infusing your body with stress. And kind of all these chemicals and hormones that are basically telling your body it's time to be awake. So again, the misalignment continues, right? So this concept of circadian alignment or misalignment is you know, can be found in the literature. There's tons and tons of papers. As you mentioned, this is a bulk of my research is kind of in this area of circadian alignment and what behaviors kind of ladder up to alignment versus not. But it's well established in the literature that this alignment is really important. And one of the best ways to create alignment is kind of sync up with the natural light dark cycles as much as humanly possible.
Okay, so I have some questions.
Yes.
I have many questions on this. So this summer I was invited to speak at Mindvalley University, and we went to Estonia, beautiful country. Oh my goodness, the food. I was so delighted to meet the people there. In the summertime, the sun sets at, and my clock did not know this. My circadian clock was not used to this, set at 11 o'clock at night. Like it was bright in the sky until 11, and we had blackout blinds in our hotel, but that sun was up at 3:30 or 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
So when you are, and this is maybe a question more for like the extremes of the earth, I'm thinking about this, you know, individuals in Finland and Sweden and Denmark and Norway, and even in France, when we were in Paris, the sun was still up at 10 at night. I'm from Toronto. So I'm in Toronto. So the sun here, you know, in the summertime it's still light at about 9 o'clock, right? So 9 o'clock, it sort of sets. And then, you know, I'm an East Coast girl, you know, so like New York, Boston, like sort of that whole Eastern corridor, like we're all kind of the same in terms of when the sun. So when I was in Paris, I was shocked that it was still light outside at 10. We were walking home from dinner and it was 10 or 10:30 at night and the sun was still out there.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about circadian alignment, is it that we are trying to align with the sun irrespective of where we are? So if you're someone in Estonia where you have 5 hours essentially where the sun is not around, is that an ideal rhythm to get into because that's the geography, the geographical location that you are in? Or is it, I want to try and get, you know, a certain amount of dark over the course of the day and a certain amount of light?
Yeah. I think this is a question that, you know, I don't know that we've arrived at the perfect answer, but I think what we know, I did this huge study with Army Alaska. So looking at a really, it's the most extreme kind of place in terms of light dark and kind of, you know, long bouts of darkness, long bouts of lightness. And we do see, not surprising, that both of these extremes seem to correlate with less positive psychological functioning. So I think there is something there that if we can kind of strive for 8-ish hours of darkness and, you know, 13 hours of light, that's probably optimal and creates the least amount of stress on our system. So I think it, ideally, you kind of just try to stay inside that schedule, you know, with an hour left or right across the entire year.
Across the year. So this is, okay. Mm-hmm. So the other thing with Estonia, I was talking to some of the locals because I couldn't believe that the sun was up so early and went to bed.
Yeah.
They were saying that in the wintertime, it's actually the opposite. So it'll, the sun will rise at about 11 and it sort of sets at about 3:30 or 4. Yeah. So does it sort of even out over the course of a year, or this is something that we want to try to be achieving on a daily basis? Like the cycle is more of a daily diurnal 7 or 8 hours, as you're saying, or does it sort of even out over the course of a year?
I think it's diurnal and we want to try to, maintain some sort of consistency across the year.
Okay. What about, okay, so same question for shift workers. Mm-hmm. And then I have a question about chronotype. So shift workers are, you know, the nurses that are working 3 days on, 2 days off, where their circadian rhythms, let's say, are potentially complete. And we know that, you know, we love our nurses, we love our shift workers, but they have the poorest health outcomes, right? I mean, I think shift work has been identified as a carcinogen and, you know, all-cause mortality. So talk to us about, what are some strategies that someone who doesn't have regular sleep-wake cycles, like a nurse, let's say, what can they be doing, if any, anything to sort of optimize their light bolus or their light exposure?
Yeah, I think establishing some sort of like consistent regular routine around these cues that we know are going to impact the circadian rhythm. So, you know, ideally eating a bulk of your calories during the biological day. So that means if you're waking up from your kind of sleep, maybe at 3 p.m., you want to try to get in a bulk of your calories from 3 p.m. to, let's say, 7 p.m. once the sun goes down. And then, you know, during your night shift, just trying to, you know, really clean, lots of protein, you know, just trying to not put too much stress on your system during what would be your biological night. So while you can't get away from having to be up during the night, you can pull the food lever to try to at least stay within the bounds of what your body is expecting during that time. So I think if you think about that, okay, what's the big principle here? It's try to do what you normally would do during the day and apply a lot of that to the night, if that means, or keep what you do during the day as often as possible. So food, exercise would be another one. You want to try to fit that in, you know, during, you know, after you wake up, for example. For some folks, even before their shift, as their shift ends, that could be a good time.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Cause they're going to be ending at like 6 or 7 in the morning, something like that.
Yeah. And they can work out. You know, it's tough though, cause you want to try to, it just depends on the human, right? And what their circumstances are. I think exercise, getting in your exercise at any time is probably is good. You know, we know that that is just such a powerful longevity for powerful lever for longevity. And I think when we, you know, even if it's kind of at a what we'd consider a suboptimal time, it's better than not doing exercise. So figuring out obviously exercise when those constraints is really important. But I think food is probably one of the biggest levers to offset any regular sleep wake time.
So trying to bookend the food, like to sort of line up either with like dinner, let's say if it's the beginning of your shift,
or
breakfast mm-hmm. if it's at the end of your shift. Okay, cool.
Yeah. But I think like eating, you know, all throughout the night is one of the worst things that you can do. And probably one of the main reasons metabolic dysfunction is so high with shift workers is because, you know, they're eating big old meals when their body's literally just not primed to metabolize food. Like we're just not set up to digest food at night. We're just not. And as a result, it puts huge amounts of stress on our body.
So they should basically be paid more, is what you're saying.
for the sacrifice. More. Like, yeah. It is such, yeah. Like I just like these humans. Yeah, we're analyzing data from, we did a study with UCSF and Las Palmas in Texas, you know, frontline healthcare clinicians, like 370 folks. And we were trying to really test like a coaching platform around these kind of these principles of circadian alignment. So really thinking more intentionally about light, you know, minimizing light in the lead up to bed and then getting a bolus of light once they wake up just to try to, yeah. And it's when I just look at the data, like just their baseline relative to age match cohorts, it's like my heart like breaks, honestly. Yeah. Like these folks cannot, yeah, they're just like heroes, truly, like in every sense of the word.
I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount, that is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
So I've had Dr. Michael Bruce on the show a couple times, very well known for his work on chronotypes. And
yeah.
I forget all the animals, Michael, I'm sorry. It's like lion, bear. I think there's a dolphin in there. there's another one. So my question is, so chronotypes, my understanding of chronotypes is it's not that, you know, or a night owl. Is that you're not completely switched, but these are just variances of by a few hours, right? So I'm so sorry, Dr. Bruce. I forget what my name
it's like
is, but I'm the one that likes to get up early. I'm the one that likes to get up early. I like to get up early, right. And then I like to be in bed early. So like I turn into a pumpkin. I like to joke, like I turn into a pumpkin about 8:30. I need to be like starting my routine at like 8 p.m.
Yeah,
and 9 o'clock. I really want to be in bed by 9. But there's others who really do, like, you know, a lot of creatives. We know that they often, like artists and things of that nature, like to actually, they're most creative in the evening.
Mm-hmm. They have a preference for evening
preference.
Work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And my question around chronotypes, is more, maybe it's more around my own family dynamics, like AKA asking for a friend. So we were talking in the pre-chat. I have, an almost teenager, I guess he's a tween. He's almost 13 and I have an 11-year-old. And so what I'm noticing with my 13-year-old is that he is now, his penchant for staying up later, his appetite for staying up later is increasing. And just understand.
Same with my son.
Same with your son. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what we do know in sort of the teenage years, there does seem to be this like phasic shift in terms of how, you know, what our chronotypes are. What are some of the things that, well, My question is this unavoidable? Is this just something that they have to do as part of their development that we don't, you know, maybe understand the reason why, or maybe we do and you can explain that. And then how, for someone like myself who likes to get up early, that obviously precludes, means getting to bed early. How do, let's say the moms and the dads who have sort of different chronotypes from their family members, how do we sort of navigate that? And then I'll ask you some questions on metabolism in a moment, but I want to talk about chronotypes, and maybe you can speak on your own personal experience or what you've seen from the data from, do we have any data in terms of, is this preventable? Like, can we just get our teenagers like to not go to bed at midnight? Is that a possibility, or am I just wishful thinking?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a light issue, right? So, you know, I really prescribe to Ken Wright's, I think, work. Dr. Ken Wright, he's a circadian physiologist and has done a lot of this work around chronotypes. And he has some interesting studies where, you know, he throws a bunch of healthy adults. So these are folks that don't have sleep disorders or, you know, circadian disorders or anything like that. Kind of throws them on a mountain. And basically, you know, within a few days, they're all falling asleep within 30 minutes of one another. Okay. So there's no artificial light, right? So they're just on a mountain, you know, kind of camping. So and when you look at like a lot of the hunter-gatherer kind of research and data, it's, you know, everyone's kind of falling asleep within a half an hour of one another. So I'm not sure that I really ascribe to this like this wild, you know, discrepancy between humans in terms of, I think a lot of it is kind of preference that you develop over time and habit. And I mean, one thing that we do know is night owls die sooner, because I think you're going outside of the bounds of what your body wants to do, and you're kind of overriding those endogenous preferences and kind of making choices that, you know, to stay up later. And we know this of shift workers as well, like all of the data that exists around, you know, just some of the health, the deteriorations in health that happen cardiovascularly and metabolically when folks are, you know, up during the night, during the biological night, and kind of sleeping during the day. So, and I think the other piece of research I think that's really compelling is we know that if you're viewing light between artificial light between the hours of 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., it has a pro-depressive effect in that it will negatively impact your dopamine system next day, your motivation, your reward system. Like it will not function as it should. So I think those are a couple examples of that, of, okay, if we can abstract from that 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. result in that beautiful study on mood circuitry and mood and brain circuitry, we know that probably after 11 p.m., there's something negative happening. So I think even for children, you know, 11:30 is probably not the time. I would say for teenagers, probably, you know, the 10:30 range is probably optimal, which is a little later than what it would be for, I think, for adults. So all that to say, I think that these chronotypes are not as wildly, our variable, our night, our sleep, wake time desires are not, endogenous preferences are not wildly different. And that there are some real deleterious effects that happen after 11 p.m. So we know that it's got to be somewhere before that.
Yeah. And I've heard Andrew Huberman talk about this as well, like this 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. You know, if you have this, if you wake up and you just, even just the moment that you check your phone, you know, you just look at the phone and just that blue light, because it's so close to your eyes, is going to have sort of deleterious effects, as you said, on the dopaminergic serotonin and, you know, melatonin release. And it'll also preclude you from just falling back to sleep. You know, sometimes you just wake up, you just come out of the sleep cycle and you just, I've noticed I'm like, I'm awake. All right. And I'll just close my eyes and go right back to sleep. But if I were to get up or look at the clock or look at my phone, which isn't in my bedroom anyway, but let's pretend that it was, that's just going to be, you know, the outcomes of that are just going to be far worse than
it
just sort
creates
of
this like vicious cycle too. You know, it's like, I think to your point, like, it fragments your sleep. I think even like when we're pushing past our pressure for sleep, and let's say we fall asleep at 1 a.m., we've been up watching Netflix or like, you know, or doing something creative and wonderful, like, falling asleep at 1 a.m., are the potential for a more fragmented sleep experience is higher, right? Because we've got all of that cortisol kind of flooding, you know, our system, our baseline kind of heart rate is going to be revving a little higher. As a result, you're not dropping into these deeper stages of sleep. You might be so sleep deprived that you're getting some sort of rebound, you know, deeper sleep. But again, like that's going to impact your architecture tomorrow and then the next day. So it just, like I said, you end up in this kind of vicious cycle where you're really not getting healthy sleep.
Yeah, I remember it was Matt Walker's book, I think, or maybe I heard him somewhere say this. He said, you know, midnight is middle of the night. And I was like, well, that's really simple and so obvious. Like it's the middle, it should be the middle of your sleep cycle. And I remember my grandmother, bless her, I miss her so much, but she used to say things like, you know, an hour before midnight, how did she say it? It was an hour before midnight is equivalent to two after, something like that. I'm messing it up. But it was like the 1 hour of sleep that you get prior to midnight is equivalent to two afterwards.
She wasn't quite right in
terms of like, you know, deep sleep and REM sleep. Like she wasn't, you know, she's a Lebanese immigrant, you know, but she would always talk, but that was sort of her wisdom. It was like, get more sleep before midnight than you get after. And I was like, And she would clean the house with vinegar. You know, she would do all these things. She would moisturize her skin with olive oil. And I was like, you know,
it's ahead of her time.
This woman was onto something. Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, let's talk about some of the metabolic implications of, I know we've been talking about light and, you know, let's talk about some of the metabolic implications of poor sleep, because I think that this is, I know for myself, when I have not slept well, my emotional regulation, I'm just calling myself out here, my proclivity for snapping, you know, or like people to annoy me with things that would never annoy me is much higher. I probably crave more crap. Like I probably just... you know, I'm thinking about chocolate maybe more than I should, or, you know, just thinking about if there's food in the house that shouldn't be there, I'm probably going to sort of be circling it, you know, like a shark, for more so than I would otherwise. Like my inhibitory, you know, sort of my prefrontal cortex, it just feels like it's offline. Like I just can't inhibit some of these sort of primal desires for sweet and, you know, and my emotional regulation. Talk to us a little bit about maybe some of the changes in fuel partitioning that might happen when we are sleep deprived.
Yeah. So there's a lot there. So basically when we are depriving ourselves of sleep, our hormones, ghrelin and leptin, are not going to function as they should. And this is why you kind of feel when you're sleep deprived, you're going to feel hunger more. You're going to feel like you're going to crave more carbohydrate rich foods. And a lot of that is because.
And it's not the sweet potatoes. It's not like the complex carbs.
I know.
It's always the Kit Kat.
You know? I know, exactly. It's like the gummy bears and the Dorito chips and stuff like that. And that's really, that's just because your ghrelin and leptin, you know, hormones aren't functioning as they normally would. So your satiety cues that are driven by leptin are kind of not, they're basically the cues that they normally would take are not there. And it's essentially your body, when it's sleep deprived, it doesn't feel safe. As a result, you know, these hormones kind of act in wonky ways to try to create safety, right? And if you think about emotional eating, that is you're trying to kind of create a safe environment, right? And obviously that's maladaptive and not healthy, generally speaking. But that's actually what's happening. There is this spot, you know, something biological going on in those moments that are kind of driving you toward these foods that will make you feel kind of more safe. But obviously over time, if we continue with that pattern, that's when it can become really unhealthy and real metabolic dysfunction that, you know, then what we know is diabetes. And you're also more, when you're sleep deprived, you're more insulin resistant. This again, you know, your blood sugar is going to be a little wonky. So you're trying to kind of balance that out, with, you know, the food intake, and that's where you can get these really big fluctuations in blood sugar over the course of the day that obviously have their own negative repercussions. And I would say just as it relates to kind of circadian rhythms, your glucose tolerance is going to be higher earlier in the day. So, you know, generally speaking, I think for women in particular, you want to make sure that we're having, you know, lots of good protein early in the day and that we're eating a bulk of our calories kind of earlier in the day, as opposed to kind of waiting until the night. And we could talk about kind of time restricted eating and fasting too, if you'd like, but
I would love to, yeah.
I think that's really important for folks to recognize that, you know, there is definitely this kind of circadian rhythm with metabolism that when we are aligned, we really help ourselves in terms of body composition and, you know, just weight loss and energy levels. I mean, you talk a lot about energy management and fatigue management, you know, eating food and, you know, thinking about our circadian rhythms and kind of when we should be taking in food is really important.
I'm so happy you brought that up because this is where I've probably changed my view on fasting. I've almost done a 180. So when fasting was sort of, you know, I think it still is a premier topic in healthcare. I think it's still very widely discussed. But when it first came out, I was really practicing fasting like a man because, you know, there was no models for women. You know, it's women
Same.
Are, you know, so I would look at some of the sort of fat people in the fasting world. And I was like, all right, I'm going to just delay my breakfast. Increase that 15 minutes every week. And then I'm going to work up to not eating until 12 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And then I would have sort of a feeding window of, let's say, 12 to 7 or 12 to 8 o'clock at night. And mm-hmm. I am someone who typically works out in the morning. Just, I know that that's not necessarily the best time to work out for strength training, but it's the time that I have. So I will usually give myself some, you know, nitrogen, like I'll, you know, have some whey or something, like some kind of protein, let's say around that time. And I found it very difficult to not have food to fuel my workouts. I found that my workouts were, my performance was being impacted. Mm-hmm. My recovery was being impacted. I was much sore for much longer and I was miserable. I was so like, let's just call it what it is. I was hangry. I was so hungry. So I started thinking about this circadian, because women, you know, I think a lot about cycles in general for women and how we live, you know, we have a fertile cycle. We have cycles of creativity. We have, you know, the seasons are cycles, yearly, all these different things. And I started thinking a lot about this sort of diurnal or the circadian rhythm. And to your point, you just said this so beautifully around being more insulin sensitive in the morning. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, let me just play with this let me just try to eat, you know, earlier in the morning or just in the peri-exercise area of my life, which is the morning, and then cut off the food a little bit later on in the day, which, you know, and the science suggests, and we've talked about it already, that's going to also help our sleep outcomes. And I'm so much happier.
I'm so much shocker.
And then of course, my performance, my recovery, all of these, my strength, my ability to focus in the gym when I want to, you know, when I really want to punch out like a great workout is awesome when I've eaten.
Yeah. Well, your workouts, let me just say your workouts are so inspiring. Like I love like following you on Instagram. I'm just like, yes. Like I just like. You're so strong and so like, you're just wonderfully fit. And it's just like super inspiring. So thank you for sharing all of your wisdom and your workouts.
You. Show my work. I got to show my work. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
But I feel like that's really important for women to know, because I think a lot of times when there are new, and I would fast like a guy, it would be like the 12 to 8 or.
No, I did the same, Stephanie. I did the same thing. Yeah. For a long
and
time.
Even just the long fasts, like that's something I don't really do anymore either. I would go, I was like strong like bull, like I'm going to go for like 3 days. I'm going to do a 96 hour fast. And I remember thinking we were moving homes and I was in the middle of a 5-day fast. And I'm like, what am I doing? I am lifting boxes. I am exhausted. You know, if you want to think about stressor upon stressor, like moving, one of the biggest stressors in life, and then not eating. So I've actually moved my entire sort of, we'll call it eating window to heavy load it in the morning. So I've had most of my calories by about 2 or 3 o'clock. And I feel great that way.
Yeah. And there's a lot of great research, you know, looking at folks late eaters versus early eaters, and early eaters by far have better outcomes in terms of body composition and metabolic outcomes. So, improvements in insulin sensitivity, even reversal of prediabetes. So, timing really, really matters. And I think it's important for folks to know that time-restricted eating has like a circadian component, whereas intermittent fasting is kind of about caloric restriction. And that's really not what we're not talking about that here, really. We're really talking about eating in line with circadian rhythms, which is essentially eating while the sun is up. And I think for women in particular, biasing a bulk of the calories, earlier in the day seems to really, based on the literature, seems to really be the best way to manage your weight and most importantly, manage your metabolic health. So so I think what you're doing is amazing. And I think for folks who are still menstruating, really understanding that, hey, during that, after ovulation and kind of in this 2 weeks leading up to menses, that is really not the time to fast. Like your body is already under, we've got estrogen and progesterone at its highest, right? There's like a lot of things happening in your body to kind of prepare for menses, or if you're pregnant to be able to carry a child. So either way, that time frame is really metabolically expensive. So if we're layering more stress on top of that, that can have a lot of negative, that can impact you negatively in that it might delay your period, might make your period come early, and then just the impact on your mood as well. So picking your times for if you're doing more traditional fasting, you want to probably do it in the back end of menses or during ovulation even. I'm so happy that there's like starting, more literature beginning to emerge and a little bit more science and thoughtfulness around just women and what it really means to kind of restrict calories and when that might be good and when it might be have a more negative, more harm than good.
Yeah. And I'm so happy to hear that. I mean, I talked about the exact same concepts in my book around fasting in the follicular phase of the first 2 weeks, let's say. Mm-hmm. And if you pay attention, your appetite cues are actually, you're less hungry. Generally, around, I don't like fasting right around ovulation because we don't want to prevent it, especially if we're trying to optimize for fertility. But you said, sort of that late bleed week, like late into week one, sort of early into week two, let's say, very good times for fast. We're just a bit more resilient for caloric restriction during that time. And agreed, there's a lot of stuff happening in the luteal phase. We're just, the way that I sort of describe it to my listeners is that you're building an organ. Like there's a lot going on. You need substrate, we need amino acids. We need free fatty acids. We need glucose. Your body's already preferentially throwing those substrates into the endometrial lining anyway, along with things like, macro minerals, micro minerals, et cetera. So it's not really the time to restrict your food.
Right.
I don't like any type of fasting other than sort of, the fasting that happens while you naturally sleep in that luteal phase, really. So I'm happy we're aligned on that. And I love what you said about, I just wrote this down, when we're sleep deprived, that our body doesn't feel safe. I thought that was I know that it's such a powerful way to think about it, that you're eating to soothe. You're eating in a way to soothe, and that, you mentioned like emotional eating. That's what it is. It's like, it's a self-soothing technique, which, when not applied properly can have these devastating consequences. Yeah. So my question to you is, okay, so let's talk about the 80-20 rule. So 80% of the time we're doing things right. We are going to bed at the same time. We're waking at the same time. What if we know that there's going to be a big event? We have a wedding coming up, or there's a big, you're going to be on in a different time zone, something like that. What are some things that we might think about leading up to the big event? Because if it's a big event, it's probably going to be in our calendars. We know what day it is. We know when our flights are, all the things. What are some things that we can prophylactically think about as a way to negate some of the negative consequences that can happen from a poor night's sleep, and probably, maybe this will lead us into an
alcohol.
There's going to be alcohol. Mm-hmm. There's going to be, there's going to be time zone changes. There's going to be interruptions in your exercise routine. What are some things that we might think about for, these one-off big events?
I love this question so much because I work with folks who are in a lot of my research is in these high stakes, high stress environments where they're going off to Afghanistan for a mission, and what does that lead up into that mission look like? Or they're going into where they've they're going to be, you know, on call for, you know, 3 days. You know, what does it look like in the lead up to that? Or, you know, we've got professional athletes who are going into, you know, to the Olympics and are traveling. Like, what does the lead up look like? So, you know, these big events, it's really about doing as much as you can, as consistently as you can in the lead up to that event. So it's not surprising. So you just, what you don't want to do is go into that kind of more irregular, erratic kind of schedule under recovered. Like, that is what is really rushing, right? So if you can kind of go in as like healthy and firing on all cylinders, you're going to be able to, override like any of the negative effects of just 2 days of like really letting it all hang out. So I think like thinking, you know, and the levers, you kind of, you know, touched them, like trying to be really regular. I mean, I think it all comes back to trying to minimize circadian disruption, right? Like, we want to try to create as much circadian alignment as possible. So that's eating while the sun is up, biasing a bulk of our calories earlier in the day, you know, ending, you know, finishing our last calorie a couple hours to 3 hours before we intend to sleep. It's called time-restricted eating, really important. Stabilizing when we go to bed and when we wake up, doing that as often as we can, getting a lot of water, you know, really trying to minimize alcohol intake, you know, putting nourishing, nutrient-dense, food in our body, really important, you know, meeting our sleep need. You know, these are just like kind of the basic stuff, you know, and I would say, you know, working out, getting exercise daily, movement, really, really important. Trying to, you know, pay attention to that sedentary behavior and not let that, you know, creep into the hours and hours over the course of the day. You know, so it's just like a lot of the typical things, but going to this event, you just want to make sure that you're as robust as possible. So you can, you know, to your point, kind of mitigate the negative effects of this disruption.
And would you change the sleep? Like, let's assume that the time, would you change the sleep patterning leading up to it? Would that be the same? Or would you try to get more sleep than you normally would? Or?
Yeah. So sleep extension can be helpful leading into events where you are going to be sleep deprived. So there's no question. A lot of folks though can't sleep longer, right? Because they've got these pronounced circadian rhythms, right? And they're used to getting up. So I would say if you can extend your sleep by maybe 30 minutes on either end, that would be the most I would really do. The other way to kind of help with potential like sleep disruption is maybe getting in like a nap, you know, after lunch for 30 minutes, no more than 30 minutes. That could be another way just to kind of, you know, just reduce some of that stress accumulation throughout the day. And again, just kind of protect you a little bit from maybe shorter sleep in the future. I would say if you're only going for like 48 hours, I would basically just try to get as much kind of sleep going into that. And then once you land, just kind of do whatever is normal is happening on that time zone. If you are going to be staying for more than 48 hours, I would try to subtly shift your circadian rhythm so you can assimilate to that new time zone. So that would mean all the levers that we've been talking about, you just want to kind of subtly shift them kind of incrementally in the lead up to your departure. So you're more shifted toward whatever time zone you're going into. And then when you're on the plane, I would, you know, eat in that time zone, view light in that time zone, restrict light based on that time zone. And then once you land, do everything in that time zone. So if you land at 7 a.m., like get lots of light, eat breakfast, like just really like, all right, new time zone. And then if you do feel really, really sleepy, make sure it's no more than 30 minutes. Like, you want to fall asleep when everyone in that time zone is falling asleep. So you have to really build that sleep pressure so you can fall asleep.
Do you know, it's a very silly trick. I'm sure that there's no data behind it, but it works really well for me. It's just changing my clock on my watch. So if I'm going to Europe, let's say, and I know that it's like 6 hours ahead, 7 hours, you know, whatever time I changed on my watch. So I'm like, oh, it's already 7 PM there. Okay. So like, I got to get in my dinner, even though it's like 2 o'clock here or, you know, 1 o'clock.
100%.
And then when we're on the plane, I'm like, oh my God, it's 12 o'clock at night. I got to get to bed, you know? So I just 100%. Start thinking about it in that time zone. And it's a silly little thing, but it works so well for me. And when I don't change the time, time on my watch, I can't seem to think in that new time zone. Like it's just that extra calculation in my head. So
I love that. Yeah, that's an awesome hack. Oh, for sure. Like, and that's the whole, yeah, you just want to try to do, again, if your goal is to kind of really assimilate to the new time zone, you want to start to adopt those behaviors. That said, you don't want to kind of, you still want to be able to kind of, unless you can really, you know, black out your curtains, eye mask, and like sleep during like what you would be sleeping, like in that normal time zone. If you can't do that, it's better just to kind of stay in your own routine. Again, be as robust kind of going into that travel as you can, and then just kind of adapt on the fly, you know, once you get there.
Let's talk a little bit about alcohol, because there's going to be, you know, just piggybacking on the, you're going to have a big night out. You don't even need to change time zones. It could be, you know, I got married this last summer and I had one glass of champagne because I thought it was momentous enough to justify, and I didn't even finish it. I had a couple sips because I don't really like alcohol, but let's talk about, I thought I should probably have some champagne on my wedding. Let's talk about, especially when you're doing cheers, you know, like you're going to just look like the crazy person. It's like, no, I'm not drinking this poison. Let's talk about alcohol and its effects on, I'd like to talk about sleep. Because I have sort of come out with a little bit of blowback. I'm a bit of a hard ass, and you can certainly redirect me if I'm being too hard here. I don't actually see any justification for alcohol. It's very difficult. Maybe a wedding, birth of a, you know, if there's the birth of a grandson or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't actually see any justification for regular consumption of alcohol. And I remember a few years back, I think it was David Sinclair's lab had published something, and sort of the media took it and ran with this idea that red wine has these, all of these sort of heart enhancing benefits.
Yeah, it's like,
yes, resveratrol. And so the amount of wine you would need to consume.
Yeah, it's four bottles of wine or something. I mean, it's just insanity.
Like you're going to kill yourself. You are going you're going to get fatty alcohol liver disease. So let's talk a little bit about alcohol. Because typically when alcohol is consumed, again, coming back to the circadian biology, it's not being consumed in the morning. It's most typically being consumed in the later hours of the day. It's a nightcap with your husband, or it's dinner with friends, let's say. And so you're usually consuming it after dinner or with dinner, let's say. And that's very close to bedtime. That's two, maybe 3 hours from bedtime. How does that affect our sleep? And then I'd like to also understand sort of what's happening, if you can speak to sort of what's happening metabolically, because we know that the liver is going to sort of prioritize metabolism of the alcohol over any of its other many processes that it you know, oversees.
Yeah. I mean, I have the benefit of seeing like just huge amounts of data, right? And there is no question that the one single behavior that is most crushing to sleep and most crushing to markers of recovery is alcohol consumption. And the closer alcohol consumption gets to bed, the more deleterious effect it has on your sleep and your recovery. And I think what some folks will say, oh, I get into deeper stages of sleep, but your sleep becomes so fragmented that the quality of your sleep is totally compromised, and you essentially don't get any REM. So while it might make you feel like you're getting into deeper sleep, you know, being unconscious and actually experiencing quality sleep are two totally different things. So
it's not sleep. It's not true sleep.
No, it isn't. So to your point, like all the restorative and regenerative effects that happen during sleep are compromised when you have alcohol in your system, because alcohol will get prioritized. Like your body has to deal with the alcohol in your system. As a result, all of the regenerative kind of functions that are happening during sleep, physically and cognitively, you know, during slow sleep and REM, literally aren't happening, right? Because your body is having to process and digest alcohol. And that's why we see such high heart rate during sleep and low heart rate variability. And this is just, you're in a sympathetic state, which again is the state where you're not actually restoring. And as a result, like you're not helping your recovery next day. And when you don't sleep, you know, you're not releasing human growth hormone, which is, you know, be protective of, you know, for mental illness and injury. And, you know, you are not getting, you know, the requisite REM sleep. So your executive function and mental control next day are going to be compromised. So it has like, just, I think to your point, like there is no literature that suggests a moderate amount of alcohol is in any way, you know, putting a deposit in your bank account. Like that is not happening.
It's definitely a withdrawal for sure. Yeah.
It is a withdrawal. Yeah. And it's, and I think like, you know, but, and it's just weighing the cost and the benefit, right? Like if you're doing it a couple times a month, yeah, like that's not a big deal. Right. But yeah, I mean, if you're having a few drinks a week, like that is going to compound and have a negative effect. And it's going to impact, you know, your sleep mostly. But then there's all sorts of other things happening in terms of just diversion of resources, you know, having to deal with the diet, you know, the metabolizing alcohol is just so costly on the system.
What I heard, I was surprised when I was researching in preparation for our conversation, I was listening to your conversation on the Woot podcast, and I'll find the episode and I'll link it in the show notes. But you were citing a study around consuming alcohol even 6 hours before sleep, and that having a negative impact. Like we sort of started off this conversation saying, yeah, it's like 2 or 3 hours before dinner. And you might say, well, it's probably going to take about an hour or two to sort of metabolize the alcohol. But in this particular podcast you were citing, and I don't know if you remember it or not, but, or if you can speak to this, but 6 hours before going to bed, like alcohol consumption will still have sort of a blast radius. It'll still have this negative impact on your sleep, which I found that fascinating, that it was such a large timeline. I wasn't aware of that large of a delta prior to hearing you say that. Yeah.
You know, what's really fascinating, and yeah, and there's lots of good literature, but what's really interesting, I look at, if I have like one glass of Prosecco, it takes, and we have this like real time heart rate and heart rate variability data, and it comes through in our stress monitor. And it basically is an algorithm that's looking at heart rate and heart rate variability continuously and maps it on a scale of 0 to 3. So you can kind of see like where your stress is throughout the day and just give you insight into kind of what might be causing stress. Well, when I have alcohol, my baseline stress is like 1.7-ish generally. When I have alcohol, I'm almost at a 3.
With one glass of Prosecco.
Which is the one glass of Prosecco. And it takes 4 hours to get back below 2, 4 hours. So like if I go to bed with that one glass of Prosecco, like I'm hovering in a 3, like I can't even drop into REM or slow wave sleep.
That's crazy.
So it's just like that, the liver basically, it can't, that detoxification process is just so expensive that it like, it's like all these processes like just can't happen simultaneously. So I think that's why, yeah, alcohol is really crushing. Just like one glass of Prosecco takes 4 hours to clear my body. Imagine if I'm having, you know, a couple drinks an hour.
And you do that 2 or 3 times a week for
2 or 3 times a week,
10, 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like you basically go throughout the day where we're supposed to be alert, we're supposed to be stressed, you know, sympathetic activation is like pretty normal, right? And then we have 2 drinks before we go to bed. Now all of a sudden, like my body's like, oh shit, okay, here we go, you know? And I'm like just revving at this rate where yeah, like it just like your body can't do anything else. It's just the reality of it.
So let's sort of pan this out a little bit. You've had some alcohol. Maybe you're someone who has a nightcap with your, you know, you're trying to take the edge off of whatever stressful day you've had. And we've demonstrably been able to show in this discussion and the research that you've been able to accumulate that you're not, it's not actual sleep. It's very fragmented to your point. You don't have the REM sleep that you should be. So you would be in theory, and not just theory, but in reality, you're racking up sleep debt, right? So you are racking up lack of sleep that you should be having. Is there a way in that, can somebody make up that debt that they are incurring, or is it just something that sort of gets washed out with time? Like how can we rectify that?
Yeah. I mean, you can't really make up for lost biological sleep, right? So all the genes that are supposed to be turning on and turning off, like, you know, that all that doesn't happen, right? If you've got alcohol in your system. So we can't ever make that up, right? That sleep is lost essentially. And what we see in our research is that, you know, if you are not getting the sleep that you need, right, and you're accumulating what we call kind of sleep debt, for every 45 minutes of sleep debt that you get, that basically results in a 10% decline in next day executive function. So you're 10% dumber with every 45 minutes of sleep debt you accrue.
Good grief.
So
10%?
Yeah, so it doesn't. 10%. So this is measured via MBAC and Stroop. So this is a year-long study that we did with McKinsey CEOs. Yeah, it is wild. And we haven't published it yet, but we've talked about the results. But, you know, so it's prelim data, but that's absolutely wild. Fascinating,
that
right? It's wild, right? I know. And I think what's like so sneaky is like we can't actually perceive our own cognitive, physical, and emotional declines generally, right? Like, and the other study that's wild is that we looked at sleep debt in these, you know, really hard charging CEOs. And we had all of their direct reports were basically filling out a survey daily on how psychologically safe they felt. So there's like, you know, Dr. Amy Edmondson, a renowned researcher from Harvard, who is like the godmother of psychological safety. And we know that psychological safety correlates with, you know, more revenue generated. When you feel psychologically safe, you can kind of bring your true self to the table. And that's where people feel, you know, the happiest and the healthiest. And what
creative.
We saw is that
yeah. mm-hmm.
creative and yeah, and just like, just, yeah. So what we saw is that for every 45 minutes of sleep debt that these CEOs accrued, their direct reports felt less psychologically safe.
Their employees.
Wow. So imagine, you know, take that same kind of theory and bring it into your home environment. Like what if I, and as CEOs, they're trying to keep it together, right? Like they have the sleep debt, but they're trying to be as great as they can for their direct reports. But what happens when I go home is just like, you know, imagine your household not feeling psychologically safe around you because you're carrying sleep debt. So that alcohol that you're having at night is creating this sleep debt invariably, which is like, isn't just impacting you, to be very clear, right? Like that sleep that you accrue is going to impact every single person you love and care about. Like you will be less patient. Just how you hold, like, and even if the CEO isn't, you know, is really doing everything they can, they're like, all right, I know I'm tired, but I'm going to just do my best to kind of bring, you know, put my best face forward. Like how their direct reports are perceiving, just even how they hold their face, right? Like I can't perceive my own declines, right? Come back to my original point. Like, as a result, like I can't control like how I'm emoting. I can't control, like I can't even perceive that these like kind of negative emotions are getting transferred to the people around me.
There's these nonverbal cues that they're picking up on.
It's like, it's just is so kind of scary to me, but also like this unbelievable opportunity for leaders or anyone who's in charge of anyone, whether that's a parent, like, I don't care who you are, you're interacting with people. I don't care if it's like the, you know, the cash register person at CVS, like she doesn't deserve it. Like my sleep debt baggage. Right. So I don't know. I just feel like it's like this responsibility we kind of have as human beings to like, yeah, just like get it together.
I think that is so powerful for everyone, you know, and my mind of course is on my, as a mother, like how do I show up when I've had a really bad night to my kids, and what are they making of that? Are they internalizing that and saying, am I, you know, gosh, I'm going to cry now, but like, are they trying to say like, oh my gosh, I'm such a bad kid. Like that's why mommy's mad at me, something like that. Right. So it is really worth thinking about protecting our sleep and really taking it seriously. Like I think that it's one of those things like, oh yeah, doc, I get it. I should drink more. I should sleep more. Like, wouldn't it be nice? But yes, it would be nice and you should do it. And you should try to figure out strategies in your family or in your, you know, in the people that can support you in raising a family where you can find sleep. And so, you know, the naps that you said, I think that's really great. I've had discussions with people who talk about taking naps You know, I've heard up to 90 minutes, no longer. I've heard no more than 20 minutes, but you know, I think there's some, you know, bio-individuality there. I typically like 10, 15 minutes is like a little siesta I like to take midday if I've had a rough, you know, let's say I had a rough night for whatever reason. Last question. So we'll end off with a banger. in terms of sleep, where do sex and orgasms fall on the improving sleep scores? Is it better at night? Is it an afternoon delight? Is it, you know, sex at dawn? What do we like? Do we, you know, some people will say, you know, good sleep starts in the morning. So is it like, should we have sex in the morning or is it in the evening? Like, what is there any literature? Do you have literature on that? Do you have anything to say on that?
I think you should have sex at both times. So morning and night.
All day long, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. All day long. So I think it's highly individual, right? But we do see sex as a sleep promoting behavior. Of course, it's consensual with a partner. Those are the data that we've been able to look at. And we do see that there are folks get into deeper stages of sleep and seem to sleep better when they're having sex with a partner. And basically how we looked at
this
the data.
Is orgasm or just sex? Is it
this orgasm? This is just reporting sex. So we don't know if they're actually climaxing. I'm sure the guys. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes. We've done podcasts on that too. Yeah.
Okay, good. We don't know that piece, but we do know that there is something really powerful about engaging in sex with a partner prior to sleep when, again, we kind of control for alcohol and, you know, basically looking at it, is it around their typical bedtime or not? So basically, because a lot of the effects would wash out if they're having sex at 3 a.m., for example. So we basically just kind of try to control some of the confounders and really look at, typical bedtime, you know, are they having sex or they're not having sex and how is that impacting sleep? And we're able to see, in fact, that sex is a sleep promoting behavior, which is really cool.
And it doesn't matter what time so we're controlling for the, you know, the 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. time when
where you're just,
All through the day, all of those things seem like if it's morning, evening or afternoon, these are just sleep promoting behavior
throughout the day, whether it's, you know, morning, you know, midday or evening. So whenever folks are reporting it, seems to have a positive effect on getting into deeper stages of sleep.
Great. That's good to know. And then do we see a difference? Do we see any sexual dimorphisms there in terms of, because there's different neurochemicals that are released, men and women, right? So we see, I know there's oxytocin, I mean, both, you know,
right.
We both release oxytocin, you know, post-orgasm anyway. Do we see any sex differences between, in terms of sleep-promoting behavior at least?
So my hypothesis here is that guys probably fall asleep. So their sleep onset latency, so how quickly they fall asleep is probably faster than women. So, and this is the typical, women like to talk after sex, guys like to sleep after sex, right?
The post-coitus cuddles.
Exactly. So, but that said, we can't actually measure when you intend to fall asleep. So, so this is like a tough one for us to be able to kind of vet in the literature and or vet in a study. But I want to do that study and at some point because I'm really curious. But my hypothesis would be, given what we know about oxytocin and just like how men feel sleepy after sex, I would imagine they probably fall asleep faster than women.
I want you to do that study as well. And I want you to come back on the show and I want you to discuss it because I think that it's so interesting because we do, just with many of the women that I've spoken to, a lot of people, like they want to feel safe, right? It's that we've been talking a lot about safety sort of all through the conversation.
The nervous system and recovery. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that sort of bonding that you feel, whether or not, you know, I mean, as you said, like it's a consensual, you know, hopefully it's a consensual relationship and all of those variables have been controlled for. But I think that there's this sex difference between men and women in terms of, especially with sex, is that feeling safe. Like men just sort of, they just really become quite flaccid, right? They just go right to sleep, right? So it's very interesting to see the differences between men and women there as well. So that would be a very interesting study. I Let me know when that's done and we'll have you on the show again.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a, you know, I think that sex behavior is definitely changing, you know, with just smartphones in bed and, you know, like this just like a whole new dynamic, I think, that has probably some really interesting effects on our physiology and our psychology and just how we evolve actually as human beings. So it's a very interesting space, I think.
I feel like our time together has just gone in an instant. We've just racked up 90 minutes together.
Crazy.
Just looking at the time here. I would love to have you. We didn't even get into, I wanted to talk, there was a couple of things I wanted to touch on. So we'll definitely have to come bring you back for part two.
I know, training. And
I know, we didn't even get
some
to
recovery. I know, but that's okay.
But this was such a good, this was part one of what will be a two-parter. If people wanted to follow your work, some of the research that you're publishing, I know that you've co-published with, you know, some very prestigious labs and your ongoing research, where can people find you and interact with you and tell them all the places?
Yeah. So I'm trying to, I have, you know, my Instagram is like not very mature, or, you know, like I haven't really figured that out entirely. Like I try to post the research. I try to post things that I think people would like and are important. But yeah. So Kristen, I need to look at my handle. Sorry.
It has some numbers on it. I know that. I'll make sure it's in the show notes. It'll be a click. It's like Kristen Holmes.
My kid's birthday. Yeah. Aww, yeah. Kristen underscore Holmes 2126. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then LinkedIn is another place where I haven't posted anything in months, but if something big happens, I definitely post there, but Instagram, probably the stories, like if, you know, we publish something or, you know, like I'll throw it in there and if I have time, I'll do like a post. The story is the quick one. I put in a lot of like good nuggets there. I mean, one nugget in there is like actually novel research that is gonna, I think, blow the space away that I'm super excited about. And it's the relationship between it's sleep-wake timing. We basically have been able to see like down to the minute we can predict your recovery next day, measured by heart rate variability and resting heart rate. So basically, with every 10 minutes of variation, you'll have a 12% chance of an abnormal HRV. At 30 minutes, the odds increase by 42%. Now, this is in freaking 18 to 23 year olds, collegiate athletes. Wow. That amount of variability is that disruptive. So just imagine a 40 year old experiencing 30 minutes of disruption. So we're going to run those analysis across every single age bucket. But this is a huge finding to be able to, like, down to the minute, be able to see like this degradation in heart rate and heart rate variability.
Fabulous.
But I post stuff like that. So
yes. And all of my, so there's like, you are in a, you know, Nerd Army Unite. You are in the safe nerd space here to talk about all of that stuff, because all of my listeners will gobble that up. Okay, so I'll make sure that I find that post as well, and that'll be in the show notes. Kristen, it was such a delight. I will make sure, I cannot wait for us to meet in person, maybe meet in Boston, you in Toronto, or somewhere, some conference somewhere. I definitely want you on for part two if you are game for that, because I think we didn't even get to exercise. We didn't even get to cold and hot. We didn't get to, you know, thermal manipulation as well.
Yeah,
I know. Sleep is such an important topic.
Great. Foundation.
Foundation for my listeners. Thank you so much for your time and focus. I really, really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. It's amazing.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.